So campaign finance disclosure is one of the hottest topics in American constitutional law and also public policy today. It's also a very complicated topic with lots of, it's actually not that complicated, but it does have a lot of nitty-gritty details. I could give you a reasonably comprehensive treatment of those details if I just stood up and lectured for an hour, which I'm not inclined to do. So here's what I'm thinking. I'm going to talk for maybe 15 or 20 minutes at most, I hope, and my aim will be to just give you a big picture overview of the law with respect to disclosure and some of the big policy issues surrounding it. And then that'll leave us plenty of time, I think, to have a conversation about details, including interesting nitty-gritty details like why don't 501c4s have to disclose? What is Crossroads GPS? What is Stephen Colbert's super PAC? Why is his 501c4 called a super PAC when in fact it isn't, right? I'm happy to talk about all that stuff if you want to. But in my presentation, I'll just give you a big picture, kind of lay the groundwork. Okay, so the debate over campaign finance disclosure can be captured with a single but broad question, which is when can and when should the government force actors to make public their political activities? And by actors, I mean wealthy corporations, I mean powerful unions, but I also mean ordinary people like us, our grandmothers, our children, right? That question has both legal and policy dimensions. This being law school, I'm going to focus on the law side of the equation, but as long as you've taken con law, then you well know that any discussion of the Constitution necessarily bleeds into a discussion of policy. So when talking about the law, we're going to get a picture of the whole thing. So let me start with a little bit of background, actually. And let me say, too, at the end of my presentation, I'm going to spend maybe 5 minutes or so giving you my own view on the matter. So I've been writing about disclosure lately. I have some thoughts that I hope are at least in some mild way insightful. I'll spend just a few minutes on that, and then we'll have our conversation. So let me start with a little bit of background. In the 1950s, the state attorney general from Alabama filed a lawsuit in which he sought, among other things, to compel the disclosure of the names of the members of the Alabama chapter of the NAACP. Well, the NAACP resisted, right? And the legal basis for their resistance was the First Amendment, freedom of association. Their claim essentially was this: we are a group of people engaged in a political and policy project to further racial equality as we see it. The government wants us to disclose our information. Why? Because they want to harass us. They want to throw bricks through our windows and otherwise drive us out of the state. That violates our freedom of association. Why? Because it's going to break up our association if they succeed, but also, and maybe more fundamentally, because it's going to deter us and other people from associating in the future. Right? Who's going to join the NAACP in Alabama or elsewhere in the South or other comparable organizations if you know the government at any time can find your name and home address and just show up? It's not going to happen, right? So the Supreme Court agreed with them and said, you're right. The First Amendment protects you here. The government cannot require you to disclose your membership information. So why am I telling you about that case? It's not a campaign finance disclosure case. But I'm telling you about it because, A, it has shaped the campaign finance disclosure laws, the way the court thinks about them, and also because it illustrates, I think, an important broader feature of disclosure. So if you read contemporary media discussions of disclosure, policy discussions, talking heads, and so forth, as I see it anyway, the focus right now is on forcing mostly right-wing wealthy groups to disclose. They want to shape politics, and they want to shape it in the shadows, and we want to bring them out from the shadows. Maybe that's all right and good. Maybe that's where ground zero is with disclosure today. But more broadly, it is not a left versus right issue, right? Sometimes disclosure helps the left and hurts the right, and other times it goes the other way. And maybe in some, I'm not accusing the right of being racist. I'm not saying today's right is anything like the Alabama government from the 1950s. I'm not saying anything like that, right? My point is just that sometimes disclosure helps one side, sometimes it helps the other. When we think about what we want a disclosure regime to look like, we ought to get out of a partisan framework and just think more generally. What's good for society to the extent we can distinguish partisanship from that separate question? Okay, so now, after I amp up my blood sugar, let me tell you a little bit about the law of disclosure, campaign finance disclosure, as it operates today. So suppose that you are an individual, or you're an organization, you're a political action committee, or a political party, or whatever else. and you're thinking of spending some money on politics. Maybe Nathan's running for office and you want to contribute some money directly to his campaign, or maybe you want to spend some money on some internet ads supporting him or opposing him. At the federal level today, in general, if you want to spend that kind of money over a certain threshold, you have to disclose. So what that means is you have to tell the government who you are, where you live, how much money you spent, depending on the circumstances, where you work, and so forth and so on. That information is all publicly available. The FEC makes it available. And there are various organizations that have taken that information from the FEC and they've turned it into easily searchable sort of databases that you can access online. Right? So if you Google many of your professors or neighbors or whoever else, it will not take you very long to figure out if they spent more than $200 on a candidate in the last election. Okay, so that's kind of the basics, right? And states have comparable laws. Many states have comparable disclosure requirements. Okay, to be clear, the government does not always require disclosure. So I mentioned earlier 501c4s. Think about Karl Rove's organization or the one he's affiliated with anyway, Crossroads GPS. A lot of people are saying, hey, this shady organization is raising lots of money and they're not disclosing. That's true. The government doesn't require them to. Maybe the government should, but so far they don't. If you're a 501c4, you don't have to disclose. So it's only in those areas where the government does require disclosure, right, that the constitutional issues become live. Okay, so what are the constitutional issues? Well, people oppose disclosure on First Amendment grounds. They challenge it, disclosure requirements on First Amendment grounds. Not the NAACP freedom of association ground so much as the freedom of speech ground. So the Supreme Court has held repeatedly that money spent on politics is tantamount to political speech. And the protection of political speech is one of the principal purposes, maybe the principal purpose of the First Amendment. So if disclosure imposes costs on spending money in politics, it imposes costs on political speech. And when you impose costs on political speech, well, you get into trouble under the First Amendment. So what does it mean to impose a cost on political speech in this context? So here's the idea. Disclosure deters political speech because people don't want to disclose. It's simple as that, right? So in the easiest case, you want to maintain your anonymity. Maybe you're just a private person and you don't want people around you to know who you support in politics. Maybe you were raised a good liberal and you've turned into a strong conservative and you'd be embarrassed if your mother found that out, right? Whatever. Maybe you're afraid of harassment and reprisals. This is a real issue, by the way. So you might remember a couple of years ago, the Target Corporation in Minnesota got in some trouble for this. I don't remember the exact details, but the gist of it was they spent some money to support a political organization that then channeled some money to a candidate for office who was pro-business, that was Target's aim, but who was also anti-gay. Well, this came to light as a consequence of disclosure, and Target got in trouble, right? There were boycotts of their business. There were demonstrations. Employees were up in arms that they were taking this position on, you know, controversial social policy. So the fear of disclosure leading to harassment or demonstrations or boycotts is not always hypothetical, right? Let me give you one more example, in some ways from the other side of the political spectrum. Proposition 8. This controversial ballot proposition in California banning same-sex marriage. Well, a lot of people contributed money to the Proposition 8 campaign. They wanted to ban same-sex marriage in the state. Under state disclosure requirements, they had to make public who they were and how much money they spent. Well, some enterprising person with access to the web came along and collected all this information, who gave what to Prop 8, and fused it with a Google map and put it all online. It's still there. You can go to 8maps.com. You go to the website, you can zero in pretty clearly on the location of a person who gave money to Prop 8. And it's just what you would expect. You look at the map. Southern California, lots and lots of dots lighting up. The Bay Area, very few dots lighting up, right? Well, people claim that they were subjected, as a consequence of that website and the information it provided, to harassment. Some people were fired from their jobs because their coworkers learned that they were anti-gay and they forced them out. Other people claim to have had their lives threatened, bricks thrown through their windows, things of that nature. So it's not totally hypothetical, right? I mean, it's a real issue. Sometimes disclosure can impose real costs and deter people, and that's a First Amendment problem. Okay. That doesn't mean disclosure is usually unconstitutional, though, as it turns out, it's almost always constitutional, at least so far. And that's because of three government interests. And this is where I'm going to start sounding like a law professor, not a lunchtime speaker, but let me just quickly walk through these, right? Okay, so interest number one, anti-corruption. So the claim is this. Lots and lots of money spent on politics that you either give to a candidate or that you spend on ads, whatever else, is not corrupt. You're not trying to buy a vote. You're just trying to support someone whose view of government and policy is like yours. But not all speech is like that. Sometimes people really do want to buy votes. And if we require disclosure, that ought to discourage that kind of activity because it's more likely to come to light, which means you're more likely to face criminal penalties, right? You can't bribe officials. So the anti-corruption interest is a powerful one, and the Supreme Court has said, okay, yeah, disclosure imposes costs on speech, but the government has this sensible anti-corruption rationale, so good enough. We'll uphold it on that ground. That doesn't apply to all disclosure requirements, but it applies to a bunch of them. We can talk about the details of that if anyone wants to. There's a second interest, which I'll mention just briefly. This is the enforcement interest. So the government caps, and it's constitutional for the government to cap, how much money you can contribute to a candidate. So if Nathan's running for office and I want to support him, I can only give him a couple thousand dollars and that's it. Now the irony here, what people complain about all the time, is that if I want to spend more than $2,000, well then I can go out and drop 10 million on television ads supporting him. That's perfectly fine, right? But I can only give so much to him directly. So the second government interest is this. Look, if we want to enforce these limits on contributions, we have to have some mechanism for keeping track of who has spent money on whom and when. Otherwise, there's no way to enforce them. And disclosure helps. Okay, so that's not a very interesting interest, but it's an important one. You can't enforce the contribution limits if you don't have information about who's given what to whom. And then let's talk for a minute about the third interest. This is really the key interest today. It's the information interest. So the claim is this. If voters know the source of speech, who funded it, who paid for it, who's behind it. That helps them assess the truthfulness and the completeness of the speech. And this is rooted, by the way, in a social science theory about what we call heuristic cues. It's not hard to understand. So here's the idea. Voters are, on the whole, pretty smart, actually, particularly when you're talking about tax policy. They know what that means. But they're busy. Right? People have jobs. They have kids. They have friends. They want to exercise. They have to cook. They have to pay their bills. Finding time to understand politics and candidates and positions with any great detail is just really, really hard to do. It's not about brains. It's not about competence. It's just about time. So especially when you realize your particular vote is very unlikely to affect the outcome, right? Who's going to spend 2 weeks, 3 months sorting out this candidate's position on this arcane issue and so forth, when at the end of the day, your vote's not going to matter one way or the other, right? The margin of victory for one side or the other is probably going to be in the millions. So what do voters do instead? They rely on heuristic cues. I don't know if this guy's a good candidate for office, and I'm not going to spend the time figuring it out, but I'm pro-environment, and the Sierra Club supports him, and it says so because they had to disclose that ad. Well, that helps me. That's a quick, easy shortcut to think, well, yeah, at least on the issue of environment, I trust the Sierra Club, I'm sort of aligned with that guy, and so forth and so on. So that's the idea. If you provide voters with information about the source of speech, they don't actually have to understand all the details. It's just really helpful to know where that speech came from. Okay, so there are our interests, anti-corruption, enforcement, and information. The information interest is where all the action is now. And that is because, well, it's actually a number of cases that led up to this, but the most recent one is Citizens United. So for legal details that we don't have to get into, but we can if you want, disclosure of expenditures, and that's what Citizens United allowed that was not allowed previously, expenditures by corporations, by unions, on television ads, on internet ads, on newspaper advertisements, all of that kind of disclosure, according to the Supreme Court, does not raise a risk of corruption. Sorry. All of that kind of spending does not raise a risk of corruption, period. There's no legally cognizable risk of corruption. So what that means then is that there's no anti-corruption interest in disclosing it. And because there's no caps on this kind of spending because of Citizens United and other cases. So there's no enforcement interest. There's nothing to enforce. So all that's left is the information interest. Anytime you're talking about American Crossroads, or Colbert's Super PAC, or whoever else, wealthy individuals, the Koch brothers, anytime you're talking about them spending money on ads, on all this kind of stuff, the only government interest that can be used to justify disclosure of that, according to the Supreme Court, is the information interest. That's it. So everything turns now on the scope and the power of that information interest. I'm not saying it should be that way, but that's how it is. that's how the court thinks about it. Okay. Two more little. So that's most of the law here, actually, at least in broad brush terms. Two little follow-ups. As I said, disclosure is almost always constitutional, but almost always. Let me give you an example of a case where it wasn't. This is a great case involving Mrs. McIntyre in Ohio. She opposed a local political issue. She spent a little bit of her own money and time printing up some flyers expressing opposition to this political issue and handing them out in a parking lot. Well, she didn't put her name on them. And it turns out this violates Ohio state law. You can't pass out anonymous political leaflets. You have to put your name on them. That's a disclosure requirement, right? So she challenges it. It again ends up in the Supreme Court. By the time they get there, Ms. McIntyre, unfortunately, has passed away. But the case goes on because of the principle of the thing, right? And what the Supreme Court says is, no way. You can't require her to disclose. There's no risk of corruption here. She's not, it's kind of a long story, but she's not buying any votes with a few leaflets, right? There's no enforcement interest here, because you can print as many leaflets as you want. There's no cap on that. And you can't plausibly claim there's an information interest. How helpful is it to voters in Ohio to know that this random person, it's not like President Obama printed the things, right? It's not like the Koch brothers. It's just an ordinary citizen. How is that providing helpful information to anyone? Well, it just can't be. So in cases like that, the court says, sorry, disclosure is unconstitutional. So you can require a lot of disclosure, but not unlimited amounts. And then one other thing I'll note, and this brings us back to the Alabama case, there's an as-applied exception. So if the law requires disclosure, but you can show in a particular case that, hey, this disclosure might be fine in general, but in this case, disclosure raises a reasonable probability that I'm going to be harassed or tormented or something, then you can get exempted from it. So the disclosure requirement still stands, but it doesn't apply to those particular people at that particular time. Okay. That's a whirlwind tour, but that gives you kind of the overview of how the law of disclosure works. Now, let me just tell you, and some of the policy arguments for and against it, right? So now let me just give you my two cents on this. I've been thinking about this a little bit lately. This legal architecture, the First Amendment problem with which all of this begins, is premised on the assumption that disclosure actually chills speech, that it imposes costs on speech, and therefore it discourages people from speaking. And my view is that that may not be true. I mean, it might be true, but it's probably not always true. And let me try to explain it to you with a cheesy analogy. So suppose that you're thinking about buying a lottery ticket, which you should never do if you're rational, by the way. It's always a bad investment, unless you really enjoy risk for risk's sake. Then you do it. But suppose that you are rational. All the same, you're thinking about buying a lottery ticket. Well, what do you want to know before you decide whether to invest in the lottery ticket? You want to know how much the ticket costs. You want to know what your odds of winning are. And you want to know what the jackpot is, right? So if you raise the price of the ticket, but you simultaneously increase the odds of winning, you might sell more tickets than you did before, right? It's kind of like going to Las Vegas, right? And you can pay the penny slots, but the maximum jackpot's $2,000, or you can pay the $10 slots, but the maximum jackpot's $1 million. It might actually be more rational to play the $10 slots, right? Cost you more to play, but the payoff is huge. Okay, so let's think about this analogy in terms of disclosure. So most people think of disclosure as imposing costs on speech, and that's it. That's like raising the price of a lottery ticket and doing nothing else. Well, if you raise the price of a ticket but leave the odds of winning and the jackpot the same, you're going to sell less tickets. That's just got to be true. But suppose disclosure doesn't do that. It raises the price of speech but also raises the odds of winning. It raises the odds of you getting the political outcome you want. If that's true, you might engage in more speech than you ever did before, even though you now have to disclose. So why might disclosure improve the odds of winning or getting the outcome you want? It's because it provides information about credibility. So let me explain. I'm using Nathan as a guinea pig the whole time today. So suppose that I'm thinking about spending a lot of money. He's running for Senate or something, and I'm thinking about spending a lot of money to support him. Well, what do I think about? before I decide to spend this money. One thing is the cost of the speech. How much is it going to cost me to run these TV ads? How much is the disclosure going to cost me? I have to disclose if I support him. And maybe he's a far right or far left politician, and disclosing my support for him is going to get me in some trouble. He's controversial, right? Well, there are other things I care about too, like his credibility. If I support him and he wins, is he actually going to vote the way he has suggested he would? That is to say, is he credible? Is he going to follow through? If the answer is yes, I'm more inclined to engage in the speech. If he is not credible, if he says he's going to vote XYZ, and I spend all this money, and he gets into office, but he's a flip-flopper. He's not going to do XYZ. He's going to do ABC. He's not credible. Well, then I don't want to support the guy, right? It doesn't make sense to engage in the speech, okay? So disclosure can help me figure out his credibility. I can consult a public disclosure record provided, by and large, by a credible third party, not by Nathan himself, right? And I can look to see if money spent in support of him is then followed by votes that help the interests that supported him, right? If Corporation X or Person Y spent a lot of money on Nathan, and I can see that in the disclosure record, and he subsequently cast votes that helps those guys, that helps me decide, hey, he's pretty credible. On the other hand, if organizations spend money on him, and then he votes in a way that doesn't help them, and they don't ever spend money on him again, well, that tells me he's not that credible. And so I'm not that inclined to engage in the speech. And it goes the other way, too, right? So suppose that I am a wealthy individual, and Nathan's in office, and I show up at his door, and I say, I really want you to vote my way on this bill tomorrow. And incidentally, I'm thinking of spending $2 million on television ads to help you out in 2 years. Well, now he has to figure out if I'm credible, right? Am I actually going to show up in 2 years and help him get reelected? If yes, he's probably more inclined, I'm not saying he should be, but he's probably more inclined to vote my way on the bill tomorrow. On the other hand, if I'm not credible, if I'm going to be long gone in 2 years, he's not going to vote. I mean, it's not in his interest, necessarily, to vote on that bill tomorrow. So politicians and speakers alike care about credibility, and in both cases, disclosure can help, right? The politician can look at the disclosure record and can see if I, the speaker now, consistently supports politicians who vote in my interest. If I do, I'm credible, right? It's in his interest to vote my way tomorrow, and so forth and so on. Okay, so disclosure can provide information about credibility. What does this do to speech? There are lots of possibilities, but let me just explain the basic logic of it. Suppose that we have a much more stringent disclosure regime that gets put into place. We require a lot more disclosure than we used to. And I'm a wealthy individual thinking about spending money on politics. 2 years down the line, I look at this disclosure record, and guess what I find out? Politicians across the board are more credible than I ever thought. If you send money their way, they will keep their promises. They will actually do it. Well, think about what this means for my decision to engage in speech. The expected value of my speech act has just gone up, right? The expected return is higher. If I spend this money, it turns out I actually will get the outcome that I want. So there's a countervailing force, right? The expected value of the speech, because of the information about credibility, has gone up, but so too is the cost. The reason I have this is because we have a more stringent disclosure regime that makes me more reluctant to speak. So in some states of the world, that cost is going to outweigh any benefit, and the conventional wisdom will be right. Disclosure imposes costs on speech, and it deters it. It chills it. But in other states of the world, it's going to go the other way. The costs associated with disclosure are not so great as to outweigh the informational gains that come in terms of assessing credibility, and I'm going to engage in more speech than I ever did before. So this can lead to a net increase in speech. Now, it doesn't have to go that way, but it can. And the mere fact that it can, I think, tells us something about the legal doctrine in this area. So for one thing, it seems to me we ought to be skeptical of the reflexive claim that, hey, there's a disclosure requirement, and that raises a First Amendment problem. No, it's not enough to say that disclosure imposes any old cost on speech. You have to show that it imposes a net cost on speech. Right? To really make out your claim, you have to say that whatever costs that flow from disclosure are not outweighed by benefits that come from having a much clearer picture of who keeps their promises and who doesn't. Now, it's very hard for a plaintiff to show this. Courts probably won't require it, but I think it's valuable to think about what it ought to look like. And then just two last points, and I'll stop. Think about the government's information interest. I told you, this is the key to disclosure requirements right now, right? This is the scope of that interest determines for the money that people care about. What can and can't be disclosed. Well, if the conventional wisdom is right and disclosure chills speech, then the information interest has a problem that has not yet been recognized. And I'm trying to write this down as fast as I can. And the problem is this. On the one hand, it's probably true that disclosure provides extra information to voters because of this heuristic cues idea we talked about. But on the other hand, if the conventional wisdom's right and disclosure chills speech, then it costs voters information too, whatever information is in the speech that was chilled. So we can't say in the abstract that disclosure systematically provides voters with more information than no disclosure. We don't know. Sometimes it probably does, and sometimes it doesn't. So the information interest is defensible, but it's not unassailable. Well, if I'm right, and disclosure can actually increase speech overall, the information interest is much stronger because it's possible for voters with disclosure not only to know more because they realize the source of the speech, but they get more speech acts. So they get, right, there's no chilling effect. There's actually a kind of facilitating effect. So if I'm right, then disclosure, the information interest is much stronger because disclosure can give voters information in two ways and not take it away in any. And then the last thing I'll tell you is this, the corruption interest. This is a problem, if I'm right. If disclosure can sometimes increase speech, and I have no reason to believe that any increase would all be non-corrupt speech, some of it ought to be corrupt speech, well, then the anti-corruption interest becomes fishy, right? The government can't say disclosure combats corruption if, in fact, it can sometimes facilitate corruption. It has to make a much more nuanced argument, which would be something like, well, sometimes disclosure helps or harms speech, sometimes it facilitates or combats corruption, but we think in this particular circumstance it combats corruption and combats enough to be good policy. And maybe they can say that, but it's going to be hard to do. Now, let me conclude. Sorry, I went on longer than I expected. This is a typical law professor problem. I'll conclude by identifying for you what I think is an irony in the disclosure debate. And again, this is if I'm right, if disclosure can actually increase speech some of the time. The irony is this. The point of disclosure, which is supported by the information interest, is to help voters identify and monitor relationships between speakers, particularly wealthy speakers, and politicians. The irony, if I'm right, is that disclosure can not only help voters monitor and identify those relationships, but it will actually increase the number of relationships they have to monitor and identify.